and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. I'm Keith Bradshaw with the New York Times, and I'll be your host this evening on behalf of the professional committee of the club. Before we get started, I'd like to do just a couple of housekeeping announcements. First of all, everybody, please turn off your cell phones now, or at least put them on quiet. If everybody checks their cell phones now, here, I'll even pull out mine. It's such a shame when you interrupt a nice documentary like this with somebody's cell phone going off. Second of all, I'd like to tell you about our upcoming events. March is about as busy a month as I can remember for us. We already had a speaker yesterday. We have a speaker this evening. And then we have three more Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of next week. Monday evening, we have another documentary, also about foreign correspondents. It's on Richard Hughes, whom many of you know. The Hughes Room is named for him, one of our legendary longtime people propping up the bar downstairs, and that'll be on Monday evening. Tuesday lunch, we have Larry Lipscher, whom many of you know, another longtime club member, talking about how those of us who are American citizens are going to face a very different set of tax obligations this year. The new Form 8938 that all overseas Americans are going to have to start figuring out and filling out in the next couple of months. And he has all sorts of criticisms of that. And then finally, on Wednesday of next week, we have a series of a group of speakers on a panel, including Tim Schwartz, who's here tonight, talking about the deadly profession of journalism after the deaths of Anthony Shadid, my colleague, and Marie Colvin, a longtime renowned war correspondent, both of them in Syria. We have a panel coming up to discuss sort of what can be done to confront the dangers of modern journalism. And then finally, beyond next week, if you'd also like to sign up for the 13th, March 13th, we have Michelle Davis. She was the press secretary for Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, during the financial crisis in the United States in late 2008. Those of you who've seen the HBO movie or read the book by Andrew Ross Sorkin probably remember her as the press secretary character who's almost ubiquitous, and they use her as a foil for explaining what was going on in the markets, how she would then explain it publicly. And she's here now to talk about the 2012 election, as well as looking back on what happened in the autumn of 2008. Well, with that, let me turn to this evening's speaker, the one you've really all come to hear, and the documentary we're about to see. Mike Chinoy, I think many of you know, longtime member of the club, now still a member, is a life absent member, former Beijing bureau chief for CNN, former senior Asia correspondent for CNN. He's been going all over the world to gather footage for tonight's documentary. And with that, I give you Mike.
Thanks very much, Keith. I'm delighted to be here. We were talking at dinner about my early memories of joining the FCC as a fledgling reporter in 1976 and remembering the large looming presence of Richard Hughes holding court at the bar in Sutherland House down in Central a long time ago. And it's nice to see so many old friends tonight. Let me tell you just a bit about this film and the project that we're doing at the U.S.-China Institute, which is part of the Annenberg School of Journalism and Communication at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. We're working on what will eventually be an 8-part documentary film series on the history of American correspondence in China from the 1940s to the present day. The premise behind the project is that the way in which the American media have covered China over all these years has really been responsible for shaping the way in which the American public and political class have understood or misunderstood China. Moreover, given the clout of organizations like the New York Times, the networks, the wire services, what American news organizations have reported about China has had a disproportionate impact on the way many people in many parts of the world, how they understand China. So we thought there would be real value in trying, in effect, to tell the story of the people who have told the China story over the years. As many of you who are journalists will know, there is often a disconnect among news consumers between what you see on TV or read in your newspaper or online and how that material got there. But anybody who's been in or around the news business will know that the way in which the story is reported, the process of covering the news, what the reporters actually do on the ground to get that story, to understand it, to write it, to transmit it, and so on, can have a decisive impact in shaping the kind of story that comes out. And that's a side that many people are unfamiliar with. And so we are looking, starting with the Chinese Civil War in the 1940s, and then going through the two decades in which Hong Kong was the base for China watching, as American and most other journals were frozen out of the People's Republic, from the Nixon visit all the way up to the present day. The Nixon trip clearly deserves attention on its own. It was, of course, a hugely important diplomatic breakthrough, but it was also a milestone in terms of journalism. In 1972, when Nixon went to China, American journalists, along with most other Western journalists, had effectively been frozen out of the People's Republic since the revolution of 1949. But because of Nixon's trip, the Chinese agreed to allow nearly 100 of the biggest names in the American media world to accompany Nixon, and they also agreed to allow the kind of coverage that they had never done before. But it was a very ambitious and complicated undertaking, and I like to characterize what you're going to see in this film as the collision of three alien civilizations: the Nixon White House, the Chinese Communist Party, and the Washington Press Corps. And the way in which they collided, interacted, the internal dynamics in each of these groups, how they worked through all of these issues, is really the story that this film tells. I should mention, it's taken about 3 years to do all the interviewing and collect all the material. And we were very lucky that in addition to excerpts from the TV networks, we were able to get a lot of fascinating footage, including home movies taken by Nixon's chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, and by one of the correspondents who went on the trip, Tom Jarrell. And most interestingly, I learned about a year and a half ago at the Nixon Library that Nixon had hired a film crew to chronicle the trip for his own personal use. He did this through a famous movie producer named David Wolper, who produced Roots and a number of other well-known films. And this crew shot all the news events, but was also given access behind the scenes that none of the other reporters had at the time. And their instructions were to essentially shoot everything. And so then for nearly 40 years, there was a huge fight over who the film belonged to. No one could figure out whether it belonged to the Nixon family or the Nixon estate or to the government or the National Archives. And only this past summer was it determined that it did, in fact, belong to the National Archives. And we only got a hold of it in the fall. And it's never been released before. And it's high-quality 16-millimeter film. And many of the most interesting kind of behind-the-scenes glimpses of Nixon, of the press, of a lot of the events comes from this footage, and it's really, really fascinating. It was a very interesting experience to go through. So with that, if we can turn the lights down, we'll get started. Nixon called this the week that changed the world, and while I tend to dismiss what a lot of politicians say as hyperbole, I think in this case it was certainly true in terms of the geopolitics, and I think it was equally true in terms of the media, as I hope you will see from this movie. So we need to get the other lights off, and then we'll get started.
Okay. Those of you who are facing that way, if you want to just flip around your chairs for the next hour and face that way, you're welcome to, or if you have a good view there, just those of you in these rows can turn around.
All right, okay.
This very moment, through the wonder of telecommunications, more people are seeing and hearing what we say than on any other such occasion in the whole history of the world.
The announcement I shall now read is being issued simultaneously in Peking and in the United States.
was when the president began his great adventure in Washington this morning, ABC's Sam Donaldson reporting.
It was gloomy and cold with snow threatening, but an Arctic blizzard couldn't have dampened President Nixon's high spirits on this morning.
On a chilly day in February 1972, President Richard Nixon, the ultimate anti-communist cold warrior, left Washington for Beijing, the heart of communist China.
The government of the People's Republic of China and the government of the United States have had great differences. We will have differences in the future. But what we must do is to find a way to see that we can have differences without being enemies in war.
For the president and the reporters accompanying him, the China trip was a journey into the unknown.
I just found myself thinking, what is President Nixon getting into? What is the United States of America getting into? And what are we journalists getting into? And then, you know, what am I getting into with this?
On Air Force One, Nixon's staffers, including Dwight Chapin, who managed the president's schedule, had set up a TV to watch live coverage of the departure. They well understood how important the press was to the success of the trip.
We always had a purpose. The purpose would underscore a presidential initiative, and coupled with that would be what you would call a media plan. And we would figure out what we would want to have be the headline, the picture, the story, and the caption.
The story here was Richard Nixon trying to counter the Soviet Union and perhaps help the U.S. extricate itself from the war in Vietnam, reversing two decades of American hostility to Mao Zedong's China. The cautious rapprochement had begun a year earlier, in April 1971, when the Chinese suddenly invited an American ping pong team competing at a tournament in Japan to visit Beijing, and allowed a handful of American reporters to cover the trip. Among them, NBC's longtime Asia correspondent, John Rich.
It's been an incredible afternoon. Chinese cheering Americans, clapping hands, Americans and Chinese holding hands. A remarkable display of warmth and goodwill.
I knew that was when the U.S. ping pong team was invited in. I knew that was a big change and that it was an important story. I realized it was a big move on their part that they wanted to improve relations with the U.S.
3 months later, President Nixon sent his national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, in utmost secrecy to Beijing at the invitation of Premier Zhou Enlai. The hope was to arrange a presidential visit. Winston Lord accompanied Kissinger.
We were entering uncharted waters. We hadn't had any contact with the Chinese for over two decades. We had been at war in Korea. We had constant propaganda exchanges and mutual isolation. And so there was a chance that this trip would not be successful, obviously.
Nixon and Kissinger were terrified news of the trip would leak out to reporters.
So to raise expectations and have all this drama and then have it go down the tubes would have been unfortunate. But more specifically, if word got out in advance, first in the United States, those who were fiercely against any rapprochement with the Chinese and the pro-Taiwan lobby would be, you know, invading the White House and pressuring us either to call it off or constraining what we could do.
But Kissinger's mission remained secret until Nixon's stunning announcement that he would visit China.
Knowing of President Nixon's expressed desire to visit the People's Republic of China, Premier Zhou Enlai, on behalf of the government of the People's Republic of China, has extended an invitation to President Nixon to visit China at an appropriate date before May 1972. President Nixon has accepted the invitation with pleasure.
This represented an extraordinary breakthrough with a great diplomatic gamble.
From the start, Nixon was obsessed that the press, with which he had a famously hostile relationship, would sabotage his China initiative. Even during Kissinger's secret trip, Nixon was furious at the New York Times. Times columnist James Reston had been in China at the same time and had been granted an interview with Premier Zhou Enlai. Zhou said nothing about Kissinger's presence, but an angry Nixon, in a conversation he secretly recorded with his aides, ordered a White House freeze on all contact with the Times.
I want the goddamn staff to understand that the blackout on the Times is total. We are not going to get anything out of Reston except a bad shake, and he did us in. He did his best to do us in. It didn't turn out that way particularly due to show and lies cooperation.
Max Frankel was then the Times Washington bureau chief.
When they published the interview with Chou En-lai, Reston had dared to ask the Chinese how they felt about having this classic red baiter now becoming their negotiating partner. And Nixon read that and decided in his particularly paranoid manner that this was that they're going to sabotage my new relationship with China by calling me a red baiter.
Yet as the China visit approached, the White House knew the press coverage was crucial. The Chinese, however, had their own doubts about the U.S. media. Yao Wei was then a young official at the Chinese Foreign Ministry's Information Department.
Well, we had the Korean War between U.S. and China, and animosity of the Cold War. China, of course, was suspicious of everything. U.S. A lot of people are still very skeptical, suspicious.
For the president, above all, and for Kissinger, they wanted this dramatic event to be covered as widely as possible by the American media, not to mention the world media. The Chinese, of course, have been incredibly paranoid and secretive and controlling the press completely, and had never been used to having probably any more than one press attaché accompany a foreign leader. So you had these two cultural and political giants clashing here.
Ed Fui was a senior producer at the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite.
And the Chinese were very, very limiting in how many journalists were able to go. So on a normal presidential trip in those days, you'd have 150, 200 journalists, some technicians, some other people, not all reporters. But on this trip, the Chinese severely limited the number.
After difficult negotiations conducted primarily by Kissinger himself, Beijing agreed to visas for 87 U.S. journalists and several dozen technicians.
There were exchanges, semi-humorous, in which Kissinger would joke about we're invading them with a media army. And
oh, I don't think they had a clue. I don't think they had any idea what was about to fall upon.
Ron Walker was Nixon's chief advance man, responsible for setting up all presidential events. In the weeks before Nixon's departure, he made two trips to China, trying to work out every detail, including how to deal with the press.
We told them they're going to be obnoxious. They're going to get here. They're going to want to cover this. They're going to want to do this. They're going to want to do that. And you've got to set the ground rules. We'll help you. We'll help enforce it. But you've got to accommodate us as we'll try and help accommodating you.
Meanwhile, in newsrooms across America, there was intense jockeying among reporters desperate to get on the historic trip. Dirk Holstead was a photographer for United Press International.
We're talking about people who would very happily push their own mothers under the wheels of the plane to get on that trip.
They had limited numbers of places for the news media, so as the trip got closer and the interest built, in New York, suddenly there are non-technicians, vice presidents, presidents, executive producers, all jumping on the bandwagon and signing on as sound men, electricians.
Richard Solomon was a China specialist on Kissinger's staff.
The American press and media officials were crawling over themselves. One young lady approached someone in the administration and said, only half-jokingly, who do I have to sleep with to get on the Nixon-China trip?
For his part, Nixon vowed to exclude reporters from the newspapers he most disliked, the New York Times and the Washington Post.
Nixon had said nobody from the Times. Somebody on his staff, whether Kissinger or other saner heads, said, you can't do that. This is the international newspaper, etc., and somehow they prevailed, and he reluctantly allowed one seat for China.
Stanley Carno had been the Washington Post's chief Asia correspondent.
Nixon doesn't want me on the trip because I'm working for the Washington Post, and he doesn't like the Washington Post. So I'll show you the list with Nixon's handwriting running through my name. Absolutely not.
Eventually, Nixon's press secretary Ron Ziegler and his chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, convinced the president he could not keep Carnot off the China trip.
It would not be unlike him to say, damn it, we're not going to let him go on that trip to China. Then that would start a process. He would say, damn it, he's not going to go on that trip to China, and he would say that to Ziegler. Ron would wait a couple of days, go back to Haldeman and say, you know, we really can't do that. This is not right. And Haldeman would go back in and raise it with Mr. Nixon, President Nixon. And he'd say, well, you know, that's how I felt. But, you know, if he's got to go, he's got to go.
With less than a month before Nixon's departure, however, the White House and the Chinese had not been able to agree on key questions concerning the press, including how the army of reporters would file their stories.
We took in three scenarios. The first scenario was bringing in three 747s where the network could file and the wires. Photos could be moved. The next scenario was to bring in three transmission trucks, large football kinds of, that we could run satellites around town. The third one was a model of a transmission center.
For reasons of national pride, the Chinese rejected Walker's first two ideas, but in just 3 weeks, they built their own transmission center, which the U.S. TV network Pool then equipped. ABC News producer Robert Siegenthaler was the Pool coordinator.
They built, to our specifications, a television station, just totally unfurnished, and the U.S. Pool took a 707 full of television equipment, and that's how we arrived in China.
As Nixon set out for China, a half dozen reporters made up the White House Pool, traveling with him on Air Force One.
We had two other newspaper guys and a camera crew. The accommodations were on Pool on Air Force One were strictly coach. It had a desk, a table in front, four seats facing each other, and no place to sleep. The technician sat in a couple of seats in the back. So you really didn't want to be Pool on Air Force One. It was a chore, except when Air Force One is heading to Shanghai and then on to Peking. Then we thought, holy cow, we're going to be among the first there.
The rest of the press corps traveled on two specially chartered planes.
They had two 707s that the White House had chartered. One was a TWA 707, and that was named Ni Hao 1. Which is Chinese for hello. And a second plane was a Pan Am Clipper, and that was named Ni Hao 2. Then they had to start worrying about, well, who was going to be on which plane? And, of course, the reporters all deemed Ni Hao 1 as the plane that they wanted to be on.
Crossing the Pacific, the mood on board was almost giddy.
It was pretty much a party atmosphere of, you know, wow, I'm finally aboard the plane. We're going to China. China. Closed for all these years. It was a little bit the feeling we're leaving Earth and going deep into the cosmos of some distant planet.
I knew nothing about China. Nobody had any idea what it really looked like. It really was like going on the moon. What are we going to see? We had no idea what to expect.
Barbara Walters of NBC's Today Show had her own anxieties. She was one of only three women reporters making the trip and had little experience covering foreign affairs.
When I was asked to go and cover it for NBC, I was amazed, scared, because I'd never been in the level, you know, with the big guys, with the Eric Severides and the Teddy White and the Walter Cronkites and so on.
Cronkite, of course, was the anchor of the CBS Evening News. Eric Severide was one of CBS's most famous correspondents and commentators. And Theodore White had covered China in the 1940s for Time magazine. But White was the exception. Most of the reporters knew little of China, their perceptions shaped by nearly a quarter century of isolation and hostility.
Most of the guys on the reporters on the trip knew nothing about China. They knew nothing.
Up until then, the idea was Mao Zedong ate babies for breakfast, so to speak. There had been this exaggerated caricature of the way the Chinese were, that they had that the communist system had essentially dehumanized.
As Air Force One descended towards Beijing, Nixon and his staff were well aware of how crucial the first TV images would be in setting the tone for the entire trip.
Central, number one, we knew the world was going to see this event, and it was going to be huge, because we were opening a door to a billion people that had been isolated, and the president said, this is just not good. So everything we did was for that camera.
Well, it was very clear that upon arrival that we would have the president and Mrs. Nixon down that stairs, and that picture with Chou En-lai would be an incredibly important picture. I mean, that was the establishing shot in virtually every newspaper the next morning.
Waiting at Beijing Airport, the reporters too wondered about the moment.
I was, I had in mind John Foster Dulles's refusal in the 1954 Vietnam conference, his refusal to shake Zhou En-lai's hand. And so I was particularly straining to see Nixon shaking Zhou En-lai's hand at the airport. And I remember having to struggle to get the right view of that, because I was going to make a point of it in my story.
The arrival was broadcast live by all the American networks.
I felt what I always feel at a time like that, great relief that it was working. And I'm not sure I don't think I had a view that this was a wonderful historical occasion. I mean, it may have been in the back of my party, but I was very grateful that the plane stopped where we had been told it would stop.
What the reporters didn't know was that even the choice of color for Pat Nixon's coat had been made with the cameras in mind.
We knew that everything was all in that muted grays and browns and greens, that army green and so forth. The only thing in red were the propaganda signs that said, running capitalist pigs or something, that were anti-American. So the idea came, let Mrs. Nixon ought to have she needed a heavy coat because it's February, and a red coat might be really set apart and make a statement. And it did.
Mrs. Nixon's coat caused a problem for CBS Evening News anchor Walter Cronkite.
He told me just before the plane pulled up to a stop, he told me, and the engines were running, so he had a shout. He said, I'm colorblind. Tell me what color Pat Nixon's coat is, if it's either green or pink, because I'm colorblind between those two colors. And so I said, fine, and as it happened, she indeed was wearing a pink coat coming off the plane.
Apart from Premier Zhou, a handful of other officials, the Chinese Army Band, and a guard of honor, which Nixon reviewed, the welcome was decidedly low-key. And it remained so as Nixon, his entourage, and the press corps headed into Beijing.
Our ride into town and what it was like, the fact that there were not people lined up in the street, the fact that there were no cheers.
This was an airport ceremony unlike any I had ever experienced in a foreign country. There were no welcome Nixon signs, there were no people lining the streets to see him come in. It was like sliding in the back door in the middle of the night.
For a president used to pomp, pageantry, and crowds, the austere reception left Nixon's aides and a skeptical press wondering about the prospects for the visit.
In Tiananmen Square, in front of the Gate of Heavenly Peace, there was no large buildup of people.
We set up cameras in Tiananmen Square, and as we went through, that camera went whoosh, because we flew right through there. Wasn't one person on the street.
When the Nixon motorcade came into Tiananmen Square, you would have expected that the sight of a big American limousine, a couple of limousines, and all the escort vehicles that were going by with the American flag flying from the flying from the fender, that would have attracted some attention. It did not.
Would you ask these people why they have come to Tiananmen Square this morning?
Yes. 他们问你们是今天到天安门来干什么?
Nearby, the Chinese had set up a filing center. Henry Bradshaw, one of the few genuine China hands making the trip, was the now defunct Washington Star's Hong Kong correspondent.
They had set up a good system. They had lots of teletype operators there. You wrote your stuff up on a typewriter and handed it to them, and they sent it out. That was standard in that all over the world at that time. This was before you had any better communication. You couldn't telephone stories out. Telephone lines weren't very good. You just had to type them and send them.
Nixon was taken to the Diaoyutai State Guest House. The official schedule called for arrest, followed by a formal meeting and then a banquet with Zhou Enlai.
An hour after we got to the guest house and landed, me being Nixon, Kissinger, arrested me. To our surprise, Zhou Enlai came back and said to Kissinger, and I was there, the chairman would like to see the president right away. Now, this caught us off guard.
Zhou Enlai just came and took the president and Henry. We have one agent with him. And we had no clue as to where he was going.
The invitation was for Nixon, Kissinger, and one note taker. Kissinger brought his assistant, Winston Lord. William Rogers, Nixon's Secretary of State, although on the China trip, was excluded, as he had been throughout the negotiations that led to the visit, part of an ongoing power struggle between Kissinger and the State Department over who would control the management of the president's foreign policy. The meeting with Mao lasted an hour, the two leaders talking mostly in generalities. But the mere fact it took place meant Mao had given his blessing to a new relationship with the U.S.
We were delighted at the beginning because this was saying to the Chinese audiences and the cadres and the people and the world that even not knowing how the negotiations on the communique and everything else on the trip was going to come out, he was putting his positive stamp on it.
But Lord's participation in the meeting and the exclusion of Secretary of State Rogers had created an embarrassing PR problem for Nixon and Kissinger.
After it's finished, the Chinese come in with a communique saying about who was there, including myself, and pictures of all of us. And Nixon and Kissinger said to Zhou Enlai and to Mao, Mr. Lord was never at this meeting. Take him out of the communiques, take him out of all the press releases, all the pictures. Because they figure, number one, if it was just Nixon and Kissinger and Rogers wasn't there as Secretary of State, that was humiliating enough. But to have a third person who was Kissinger's special assistant instead of Rogers was really too much. And I understood this. The Chinese, I don't think, figured out what was going on.
Lord was cropped out of all the pictures. Years later, the Chinese gave him the originals. The episode highlighted the internal tensions on the U.S. side that would soon come to a head, even as Nixon's entourage struggled to keep the press in the dark.
They held serious and frank discussions. Taking part on the American side was Dr. Henry A. Kissinger, President Nixon's advisor for national security affairs. Taking part on the Chinese side were Premier of State Council Zhou Enlai, Deputy Director of Protocol of the Foreign Ministry Wang Haijun, and the interpreter was Tang Wenxian.
Can you tell us specifically what the topics were that were discussed?
No, I'm not prepared to give you any information about the meetings at this time.
That no American journalists were allowed to cover the meeting left the reporters furious.
It was announced that the president had gone to see Chairman Mao. I don't remember the exact sequence here, but he'd gone to see Chairman Mao, and it was, well, what press is with him? There is no press with him. I would say the discontent and disappointment in the press corps was, including myself, very high. And there were complaints. Were there ever complaints of saying, how could you do this? We come all this way, we come halfway around the world, and this is a case of you're manipulating the news, that you're controlling the news.
For Nixon, it didn't matter. He had the image he wanted, the first meeting with Mao by an American leader.
Then Zhou Enlai takes him from there to the first plenary session at the Great Hall of People. And we don't have any press there. All of a sudden we get the word, they're at the Great, we hauled ass and got over there as fast as we could, got the pool in there immediately.
As the Nixon-Zhou meeting ended, the press corps was assembled on the steps of the Great Hall to watch the president arrive for a welcoming banquet. Another set-piece event designed for American TV.
This is a CBS News special report. The President in China. Banquet in the Great Hall.
they timed events so that because of the 12-hour time difference between events here in Washington and Beijing, that there would be evening events, for example, the banquets, that would be timed for the morning television shows. And so Americans would be having their breakfast coffee watching Nixon and Zhou Enlai toasting at an evening banquet in Beijing, and all of that was very carefully organized.
It was breakfast time in the U.S. Viewers saw Nixon and Zhou Enlai toast each other and talk about a new relationship.
In conclusion, I propose a toast to the health of President Nixon and Mrs. Nixon, to the health of our other American guests, to the health of all our friends and comrades present, and to the friendship between the Chinese and American peoples.
The obvious and surprising warmth as Nixon exchanged toasts with Zhou Enlai and other officials was evident to U.S. television viewers, and it was exactly what the White House wanted.
We knew that there were going to be toasts and the clicking of the glass, and that was what we were after. That was the shot.
The next day, after a brief photo opportunity, Nixon and Kissinger began negotiations with Zhou on a communique that would form the basis of a new U.S.-China relationship. Both sides agreed on the need for secrecy.
They were very, 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 how shall I put it, diplomatically cautious about that.
But Zhou had ensured that the official People's Daily highlighted the Mao meeting and Nixon's presence in Beijing.
Today's edition of the Communist Party-controlled newspaper, People's Daily, removed the question mark by coming out with full front-page coverage, including three photographs and two banner headlines on the Nixon visit. Chinese are telling their people through these papers, which are circulated to millions on the streets, about as much as the Nixon White House is telling American newsmen about the substance of his private talks. This paper has about the same line as the White House, that the two met with frank and serious talks. No more substance about details of the talks is given here than the American press is being told.
We go to Dan Rather and Bernard Kalb in Peking.
Well, Dan, we've been here in Peking now a couple of days, and we've seen each day provide its own sensation.
The Chinese now, and I think for the first time, made it clear that they have a very large stake in these talks.
With the real business of the summit taking place behind closed doors, the reporters were left to cover Mrs. Nixon or offer carefully controlled visits to various Chinese work units.
We would each be given a menu of events first thing in the morning. You can pick, quite literally, one from column A and one from column B. You can go to the Chinese-Korean People's Friendship Commune, or you can go to such and such a hospital and observe an operation being done, you know, with nothing more than those little needles being manipulated.
Mrs. Nixon's first foray was to the kitchen of the Beijing Hotel.
Mrs. Nixon, would you be kind enough to describe for our audience some of the beautiful foods you saw inside?
Our food is so exquisite that each dish was a treat.
These were things that didn't have to do with politics, but had to do with the way a society lives that were brand new to us.
Indeed, it was also new that ABC brought in Harvard China scholar Jim Thompson to show anchor Howard K. Smith how to use chopsticks.
With chopsticks, I would eat lightly. I couldn't make anything stick. Show me how you do it.
Stanley, I'm told that Mr. Kissinger has improved his technique, that no one knows if the president has taken chopstick lessons yet.
On the second night, the president and his party were invited to the theater to see a revolutionary ballet created by Zhang Qing, Chairman Mao's wife. She was a former actress, more radical than Mao or Zhou, and opposed to accommodation with the West.
She was Mao's second or third wife. She was much younger. She was in charge of the Cultural Revolution. She said, this is what you're listening to. This is what you're going to be watching. This is what you're going to be taught in the school. She was, when it had to do with culture, Zhang Jing, Madame Mao, played probably a more important role than her husband.
The The ballet was broadcast live by the U.S. networks.
ABC's Ted Koppel is there, and we'll call him in now for a report on just what is taking place.
Good morning, Frank. This opera, as are all the operas that are currently in favor in the People's Republic of China, has a none too subtle political theme.
When it ended, Nixon, flanked by Zhou Enlai on one side and Zhang Qing, Zhou's bitter political rival, on the other, clapped politely. Later, when asked his opinion by reporters, the president struggled to find something positive to say.
The ballet was, of course, as we all know, had its message.
The morning after the ballet, it snowed.
Went to the window, and it was just before dawn, but just up front. Thousands, many thousands of Chinese, men and women, with rudimentary rakes and brushes, they were cleaning the streets and sidewalks of the snow by hand. And I sat at the window in transfixed awe, with all kinds of questions going through my head, saying, look at this scene, embed this scene, Dan. You've never seen anything like this before. What moves them to do this? What gets them to do this? How can this be happening? And I sat there literally transfixed for a very long time to watch that.
The press had been warned about Beijing's cold weather.
We all went out and we bought these long johns. That became what we wore every day that we were in China. The problem with that was that most of the time we were there, we were in these overheated state halls, and we would just absolutely be baking inside these long johns. And there was no laundry facilities. So within a day or two, we couldn't stand to be near each other.
All the reporters accompanying Nixon were assigned Chinese government minders. They served as translators and guides, but were also there to keep the press in line.
The minders were uptight. They were all very tight. They were seeing these alien people. Their instructions were, don't let them go where they're not supposed to go.
And I remember the one thing of interest I got out of our interpreter. I said, do me a favor, every place I go, I like to hear what the local humor is. Tell me a Chinese joke. And I would get these vacant stares. And I'd say, you know, a joke, something to make you laugh. And the answer I got over and over was, I don't know any jokes.
But Barbara Walters managed to convince her interpreter to do an on-camera interview.
It was very difficult to get the Chinese to respond. They were so indoctrinated to just say, give you the same party line. By using my own experience, I have a little girl at home, and I miss her. Do you miss your children? Then, well, my children are not with me. Or my little girl goes to school with boys and girls. Do you know my children go to school, the girls go, the boys go? And now all of this was not on camera, but all of this was a way of warming them up.
One of the interpreters even got in trouble because he was helping a network, a lady, I don't have to say the name, but we told everybody don't interview the staff. Well, this lady took this interpreter and went to the studio and motioned to the cameraman, and here are all the lights turned on. And he said, no, I cannot be interviewed, but he was on the television already.
Photographers and technicians had their own minders who struggled to make sense of the complex technology being used to cover the visit.
On the day that Nixon arrived at the airport, the pool van that was transmitting the arrival images, they went through their coverage, And the Chinese minder was just amazed as director would, you know, cut to camera one, let's have camera three, bing, 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 and all this stuff. And at the end of that transmitting session, the minder turned to the director and the band, and he says, "Well, I think I understand almost everything. I understand about the feed and the bird, but there's one thing you kept saying that I don't understand. Can you please tell me, what is this fucking audio?"
Despite the drama, as Nixon's visit progressed, the reporters became increasingly frustrated at their inability to get beyond staged events and photo opportunities.
If you complained, and we did complain, the reaction from the White House press representatives of the Nixon administration were, they shrugged their shoulders and said, you know, we're in China and we have to do things the Chinese way.
A few of us badgered the hell out of our so-called hosts, our minders, I guess is the right word, that we were getting sick and tired of these late-on events. And was there no chance at all to engage some real people?
The result, the Chinese laid on a visit to a people's commune.
Perhaps no single aspect of life in communist China has received more publicity and less understanding in the United States than that of the commune. The Red Star People's Commune, which is on the outskirts of Peking, is reputed to be one of the best in China, which, quite obviously, is why we were brought here.
Some journalists, including Robert Keatley of the Wall Street Journal, were taken to Beijing University, where they met the vice chairman of the Revolutionary Committee, an American-educated physicist.
This was an intelligent, accomplished man who was well-known in his field. And he sat there and described how, thanks to the thoughts of Chairman Mao, they had reorganized the university and let workers and peasants in, but of course nobody, almost nobody was there. The school was basically shut down. It was just all nonsense. And you just felt sorry for him, because you know he couldn't believe a word he said.
When the Washington Post's Stanley Carno asked about the fate of Nie Yuanzi, a prominent cultural revolution activist at Beijing University, he got nowhere.
When I asked the question about Nie Yuanzi, and you're at the table with them, and so you start asking questions, whatever happened to Nie Yuanzi? Mr. Carno, have you tried this Szechuan somewhere? They kept ducking every question.
Some reporters decided to elude their minders and strike out on their own.
I managed to shake the minders, and there were several of them, for just a couple of minutes, and got around it, what couldn't have been more than three quarters of a block around the corner from the hotel, into a small shop. And the camera crew joined me there. We had a little plan where the camera crew would go in one direction, I would go in another direction, and the camera crew would even split up, trying to make it difficult for the minders. And the plan was we'd meet up around the corner, which we did, and go into this small shop. The minders came in just as we were starting to videotape with the camera rolling. The minders clearly were looking at one another saying, well, we don't want to be on camera intruding. On the other hand, this is not supposed to be happening. The minders then moved in and made it clear, you know, you're not supposed to be here. You've got to get back to the hotel.
Tensions also began to emerge between the print reporters and their TV counterparts.
Pretty frustrating, because it was all about television, and I wasn't in TV.
We became factionalized because the print people wanted some real contact, wanted to really get to talk to some Chinese people, or as per the episode at the university, and we wanted some sense of the real diplomacy going on, whereas the TV people were transmitting pictures that were in themselves sufficient novelty to satisfy their curiosities and their needs.
Well, the print people were very put out with us. I mean, people, you know, the whole New York Times team headed by Max Frankel, you know, Teddy White, who had written the definitive stories about China, and here were we on before they were, and they were very resentful.
of the tension, the fact that the White House, recognizing the power of television, had designed the trip with TV coverage as a top priority.
We knew daily how the trip was covered. We knew hourly how the trip was covered. We would get reports from back from our media operation in the White House.
What Nixon really wanted was a television extravaganza. He didn't want print reporters. He didn't care about print reporters. He cared about television. He wanted a television extravaganza.
Nowhere was the impact of television more evident than when Nixon visited the Great Wall.
It basically looked like the picture postcard does, that you always see. It ran forever, and it was higher than anyone thought. So the cameraman with all of the hefty gear and so forth was breathing hard to get up, and we kept up with everyone. But there were photo ops, and they had the best possible camera positions.
When Dan Rather learned that CBS anchorman Walter Cronkite would cover the event, he was furious.
I wasn't happy about it. Walter Cronkite, who was the anchor and managing editor of the CBS Evening News and the face of CBS News at that time, he was going to go to the wall. So what was said to me is, Dan, you're going to stay back in Beijing, and you will handle some of the subsidiary coverage. I wouldn't say that I blew a gasket over that, but I was not happy.
CBS had issued us very nice coats and hats and long underwear because it was going to be so cold in China. But Cronkite had a pair of electric socks, like a duck hunter would wear, and the socks kept shorting out on him.
The images were, in fact, spectacular. Nixon was left almost at a loss for words.
I think that you would have to conclude that this is a great wall.
From the wall, Nixon headed for another famous site, the Ming Tombs.
When Nixon went to visit Ming Tombs, for instance, you know, the Beijing Foreign Affairs Bureau at that time was led by a military representative, because that was not very far from the Cultural Revolution. He ordered some school children all dressed in the best sweaters, colorful sweaters, giving each person a transistor radio.
This was late February, damn cold out there. And here were all these Chinese wearing their warmest gear, but they were there taking photographs of one another, listening to the radio, having a picnic. And I thought to myself, I mean, this is really dumb.
Nixon visited the Ming Tombs today. He found an idyllic scene, peopled with the great masses sitting around in their Sunday finery. There were just a couple of things wrong with the picture, though. These people were especially brought here so that they could be seen by the Nixon party and photographed by the drove of newsmen traveling with the president. These pictures are, in short, a put-up job.
So I told my crew, when the bus comes to pick us up, we're not getting on the bus. Just go hide behind that building over there, and we'll come out. And I want to see what happens to the crowd. And sure enough, as soon as the reporters left, trucks came. Cadre came by with baskets. They picked up all the tape recorders. They picked up all the cameras. They picked up all the portable radios, right? Put them in the baskets. They loaded the people on the trucks, and off they went.
You can tell it's a stage thing. I felt so embarrassed, as well as a lot of my colleagues.
And in fact, Henry Kissinger told me later that after our piece aired and we showed that, that he received an apology from Joe and Lai, who said that was really kind of ham-fisted of us, and I'm sorry that we did that.
The next day, as the cameras rolled and the snow fell, Nixon toured the Forbidden City, another compelling photo opportunity. Nicholas Platt was on the trip as an aide to Secretary of State William Rogers.
The White House was choreographing it, and the Chinese understood exactly what they were trying to do and was very, very supportive of their efforts.
Nixon kept close tabs, even discussing the Forbidden City TV images with Zhou Enlai.
I don't know how it came off on television, but I bet it was beautiful.
Indeed, with a presidential election scheduled in the U.S. for November 1972, some correspondents began to feel they were little more than props in a giant Nixon campaign commercial.
It's an election year, and the fact that all of this was happening at the beginning of 1972 was hardly lost on us, and so to that
that extent, we're part of a partisan propaganda effort.
This had all the trappings and all the inner core of a campaign trip. No doubt that we were on a re-elect President Nixon campaign trip.
You must take more pictures of your president.
Oh, they have lots of me.
The frustration of the press was compounded because the reporters were getting almost no details about Nixon's talks with the Chinese.
There was nothing at all. They met, they met for 20 minutes, they met for 2 hours. They met in the such and such a hall, some of those who were present, just the bare bones. What we wanted to know is, did they discuss Taiwan? Did they discuss the Soviet Union? Did they discuss military matters? Did they discuss future trade?
But as they left Beijing to cover Nixon's next stops, the scenic resort of Hangzhou and then Shanghai, the press remained in the dark about the negotiations, preoccupied instead with the quirks of the Chinese system.
It was so totally, totally foreign. And I remembered that I had asked for hot water because in those days I was boiling my contact lenses, and every time I asked for hot water, they sent me tea.
There was a particularly embarrassing incident involving a young aide to Nixon's press secretary Ron Ziegler named Diane Sawyer, now the evening news anchor at ABC.
We're all on the bus, and just as the bus was ready to leave the airport, a Chinese guy came running out of the hotel, and he had a pantyhose, and he was clearly agitated. He thought someone had left this behind in their room. Well, it was Diane Sawyer who came forward in the bus to claim that, but I guess she had just thrown them away. I don't know. But in those dark days in China, a poverty-stricken country still, the notion that somebody would throw away a perfectly good pair of pants just didn't cross this guy's radar screen at all.
By this point, the reporters had been working around the clock for days, as the only correspondent for the New York Times, Max Frankel, was struggling.
Most days, there were three articles. There would be a news article and a news analysis, and then the notebook. And that took most of the night. You know, I was living on aspirins, and I discovered that aftershave lotion was very good for waking you up.
Just to keep awake, I would go back to my room briefly, and they had tangerines. They were delicious tangerines, and we had all brought Stock's liquor. Those days I was drinking Jack Daniels. So I'd go back to my room and grab a couple of tangerines and a Jack Daniels, and then go back into the dark room and continue processing film. Well, remember, this poor minder had to be up as long as I was up. And about the third night of this, about 5 o'clock in the morning, I came out of the dark room and the minder was like sprawled on the floor in front of the dark room. And he said, "Please, Mr. Halstead, you must get some rest. You're going to die soon if you don't get some rest."
NBC's Barbara Walters was having a particularly tough time, resented and shunned by many of her male colleagues.
I sort of aggravated them. And the fact that I was a woman, that I hadn't paid my dues in the Associated Press, the United Press, the way they did. The fact that they thought that I was getting special treatment. And the most difficult part of it for me was at night when we weren't working. Nobody asked me to come and have dinner with them. Nobody said, "Do you want to have a beer?" Just as well, I didn't like beer. I found it a very important trip, but I was very lonely. I really had no one to share it with.
In their private meetings, Nixon and Kissinger had reached agreement with the Chinese on a communique. The sticking point had been Taiwan, the island 90 miles off the Chinese coast, ruled by Mao's old enemy, Chiang Kai-shek. He lost the civil war that brought the communists to power. The Americans and Chinese found a formula to acknowledge Beijing's claim to the island while stressing the U.S. commitment to resolving the issue peacefully. But the text of the communique wasn't shared with Secretary of State Rogers.
I thought that there was difficulty in drafting the Shanghai communique between the American delegation and the Chinese. What I didn't realize is that the problem was within the American delegation when Marshall Green, who was on the trip, objected to the cavalier way that they brushed off Taiwan.
Marshall Green was the State Department's top Asia expert.
And they were not acting out of pique. They were just, they looked at it analytically, and they said, there's some mistakes here. And there are some wording changes that really need to be made, and some issues that need to be raised.
The main one, which Green and Rogers raised with Nixon and Kissinger during the president's stop in Hangzhou, had to do with Taiwan. Kissinger had agreed on language reiterating Washington's mutual security treaties with Japan and South Korea, while there was no reference to U.S. treaty obligations to Taiwan. Kissinger had also accepted China's demand to include the phrase, all Chinese on both sides of the Taiwan Strait agree that there is one China. Green argued that not all people in Taiwan accepted this view.
There was significant concern, and there was a lot of tension. There was tension with the president. There was a tension within the staff. There was tension in terms of how it was going to be interpreted back at home among conservatives. And so it was a very, very delicate several hours.
Kissinger was furious. Nixon was furious. But, you know, if you don't show the pros what you're doing, there's a chance that maybe you got something wrong.
However, the Chinese would not agree to drop the word all and refused to accept any reference to the U.S.-Taiwan Defense Treaty. Kissinger eventually agreed to eliminate the section on U.S. security commitments altogether. The word all remained in the document. The agreement was unveiled in Shanghai, Nixon's last stop. It became known as the Shanghai Communique. The president's conservative critics were bitterly opposed. One newspaper wrote, they got Taiwan, we got egg rolls. But that was a minority view.
Eminently skillful, because it finessed the whole issue. It allowed us to sidestep Taiwan and get on with the business of forming a relationship with the mainland.
Nope. Introduction?
I see.
Indeed, for the president and for most Americans, the power of the images was much more important than the details of the communique.
Nixon knew he was going to get this political windfall beyond his greatest wishes, that whether they had a communique at the end of the talks was important for the diplomats and important for the political foreign affairs reporters. But for the generalist like me, he had already hit the home run.
Like their viewers, the reporters were captivated by what they saw in China.
It was China, the mystery, the dragon, the hidden kingdom, the secret country, etc., etc. And the television was a wow. Because everything in China, wherever you put your camera, you got exotic pictures.
It was a kind of a love affair with an earlier China that didn't exist anymore. You know, the exotic China, Marco Polo, all of that stuff.
And they were equally captivated by the charm of Premier Zhou Enlai.
Is the Premier happy with the talk?
It's already has been stated in the communique, hasn't it? I don't have anything more to add to that communique.
We also had a conversation. Zhou Enlai was saying how badly, how desperately China needed to upgrade its education system. It needed to move from being a closed society with a closed education system to learning what they could from other education systems and also emphasizing the best of their own. It was a deep and meaningful conversation with Zhou Enlai, which I treasure to this day.
Nixon and his entourage said their farewells to Zhou and other Chinese officials at Shanghai Airport. There was also a farewell banquet laid on for the exhausted reporters.
I literally fell asleep on my plate. I mean, you know, I conked over the table and somebody had to revive me. It was pretty exhausting. I counted it up later. It was 35,000 words. In 8 days.
the crew of the Pan Am press charter served us hamburgers and hot dogs on the way out of Shanghai, and a hot dog never tasted better.
From old China hands like Theodore White to the vast majority who'd never been there or covered the country, the reporters' heads were spinning as they tried to process what they'd seen.
Nixon called it the week to change the world, and it was. It was a big event.
And this is what's important. It changed our view of China, but it also changed China's view of the United States.
I think from the pictures, it introduced the American public to almost a magic kingdom.
The impact of television on an American audience was extraordinary. China has suddenly come alive, and all the rest is commentary.
The Nixon trip to China was, without any doubt, the most important presidential trip ever. With the exception of a president going to Mars, I mean, nobody is going to be able to do a trip like that again.
A lot of people really enjoyed that, and we have the special privilege this evening of having the editor, writer, producer, narrator of the show right here with us. So who would like to ask the first question? Marty.
Just a little point. You credited Henry Tang. Is that
not this Henry Tang?
That's all I wanted to know.
Who's next? Back over there, please. Eric.
Mike and Keith, Eric Wisher, AFP. Very practical question. I thought that was fascinating. Congratulations. Purely practical question. How can you see this? I mean, how is it accessible on the internet, or is
yes,
it? I mean, because I'd love to show my, you know, the reporters and AFP this. I mean, it's just a fantastic document.
Yeah, this is available online at, if you go to the website of the U.S. China Institute, which is simply china.usc.edu, you come to the homepage and you'll see there are actually two films that are available. One I also showed here a year and a half ago, some of you may have come to see it, which is called Opening Up, which is the story of the first generation of American reporters who opened bureaus in Beijing after the normalization of relations. But you'll see it'll say Simon China, the week that changed the world. You can click on it, and there's a version with Chinese subtitles as well if you want to share it with Chinese friends. I would like, given the way this has not been on a television network for a variety of reasons, but it is available. We have a YouTube channel as well. And to the extent that any of you feel able to go to our website and find that link and put it on your Facebook page or tweet it or otherwise spread the word so that more people can see it, we would be very appreciative.
A modern social media way to promote something about media before social media.
Right.
Okay, do we have somebody out on the veranda? Over here, please.
What the film seemed to demonstrate to me was two things which came out very clearly. Firstly, the cynicism of Nixon and his objectives on this trip, purely political, absolutely cynical. There was no agenda. It was simply for political purposes. And the other striking thing was the naivety, if I put it that way, of the US press corps. They thought they'd landed on the moon, they didn't know what the hell was happening in China. How could they be so naive? Incredible to me.
Well,
your views.
Well, I would say two things. On Nixon's motives, I was not in my youth a fan of Richard Nixon. I spent more time out demonstrating against the war in Vietnam. But I must say, I think they absolutely cynically saw this as something that would advance his political interest in his reelection process. But he did have a strategic, a greater strategic goal here. I mean, this was designed to create pressure on the Soviets by forging a relationship with the Chinese. You know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And it did have a significant impact. So I think you have to give Nixon and Kissinger some credit for having a kind of a geopolitical sense. But they certainly structured it for maximum political effect, and it worked. He won a landslide victory, which is why it's so ironic that he didn't have to do any of the stuff that was done in Watergate in order to advance his political objectives, because he would have run away with the election without it. In terms of the press, you're right. On the other hand, from 1949 until this trip, with a couple of exceptions in 1971, essentially the American media had not been allowed into China. You had a core of China watchers, including your dad, who we should acknowledge is the Henry Bradshaw in the film, and also the guy with the big furry hat walking, writing in the notebook, who was a China watcher here in Hong Kong. There were people who followed it. But on this particular trip, there were four or five people who went who actually knew something about Asia. I mean, you literally count them. There was Henry Bradshaw, there was Stanley Carnot of the Washington Post, Bernard Kalb of CBS, who'd been in Asia throughout most of the 50s and 60s. Ted Koppel had been ABC's Hong Kong bureau chief from 69 to 71, and Teddy White. But other than that, it was the people on the trip were a combination of the big anchors, the big commentators, people that Nixon liked from, you know, the Des Moines Register, people that he thought would be favorable to him, James Michener, the author, William F. Buckley, the columnist. It was a very odd collection of people. So you had very few people who knew anything about China to begin with. And secondly, I remember sitting in my living room watching this, and it was like watching the moon landing. In point of fact, until Nixon went to China, there had been more minutes of live coverage on American television from the moon than there had been from China. I mean, it really was that. And so there is this kind of, gosh, you know, here we are. Look around. You know, wow, they have bicycles here. You know, they, you know, people have families here. They have farms. And the reporters who wanted to try and get beyond that, of whom there were relatively few, were stymied at every opportunity. Just because you were in China didn't mean you were going to learn anything, because the Chinese weren't going to tell you, and the Nixon people were very happy to keep the focus on Nixon, and they didn't want reporters digging into what was actually going on in China. So I think the main impact in terms of the reporters was simply humanizing China. I mean, these were the blue ants. These were the enemy. We'd fought them in Korea. They'd gone crazy in the Cultural Revolution. So simply that the Chinese were like people who had kids and lives was itself, I think, a big step forward. But your broader point about the level of ignorance is absolutely true. And the reporters themselves that I spoke to, they recognized it.
Okay. Who? Over here, please.
Would the history be different if there were Chinese expats in the delegation?
Chinese
experts
in the
watchers.
I mean, in the press.
In this whole delegation.
Well, I mean, Nixon had China experts, but he didn't listen to them. In fact, because Nixon and Kissinger so distrusted the State Department, they wouldn't even let the State Department's own translators in on the key meetings. Chaz Freeman, who was the State Department's top Chinese speaker, was deliberately excluded from the meeting with Mao because Nixon didn't trust the State Department. Their logic was, we're doing something that's so politically explosive in the States that we can't let anything leak. And that's why they didn't tell anyone. And given that he was essentially betraying his political base, which was the right-wing, conservative, pro-Taiwan constituency, you can sort of understand why they thought that way. As it was, the way he sold it to that constituency was to say, this is my master stroke to outfox the Russians, and the Russians are going to, really created a problem for them in reshaping the global balance of power, and therefore you have to put up with me essentially throwing Taiwan off the cliff.
Okay. Who next? Coming up here, please.
So, following this trip, what happened next? A lot of trips to Mars, or, you know, space trips, people ask, when do we go back?
Well, what happened, I mean, lots of things happened next, but the I would say the most relevant were in 73, the U.S. and China agreed to that each country could open a liaison office in the other country's capital, which was not an embassy that meant establishing diplomatic relations, but it meant having a diplomatic presence. And Nick Platt actually was part of the group that went in 73 and opened the U.S. liaison office. And it's a diplomatic fiction, but it allowed them to deal with each other. In terms of the press, in 73, the Chinese let each of the big networks in to do a documentary. Ted Koppel went back for 10 weeks in 1973 and did a long film, and that will, in a subsequent episode of my project, I'm going to talk about all of that. And there were occasional tightly controlled visits by some reporters. This helped strengthen the hand in China of the more so-called moderate faction, the more pragmatic group of people who wanted to put ideology to the side and kind of rebuild China. And it's not entirely a coincidence that in 73, Deng Xiaoping, who'd been purged in the Cultural Revolution, was brought back by Zhou Enlai with Mao's acquiescence and put in charge of the economy. And so I think internally in China, it was important for strengthening the hand of that group, which meant that in 76, when the Madame Mao and the Gang of Four made their big push to power, it strengthened the forces that were against that, who essentially ousted her after Mao's death. Obviously, tons more happened, but those are the highlights. Some of the highlights.
While people think about maybe one or two more questions, you're working on another episode. I guess you're looking for support for that
right.
episode.
Well, I mean, we have an episode that is done now on the Chinese Civil War of the 1940s. It's almost done, except I showed this film at Stanford, and afterwards a very elderly man came up and said, "Oh, I worked for UPI in Shanghai in 1948, and I happen to have my video camera, so I have to add him to that episode." But I'm working now on an episode about Hong Kong, on China watching in Hong Kong in the 50s and 60s and early 70s, because before Hong Kong became synonymous with economic boom, the miracle of the that it evolved into, its key role in many ways internationally in the 50s and much of the 60s was as the listening post, where a very interesting collection of journalists and diplomats and spies and so forth sat here and tried to read the tea leaves on the other side of the quote-unquote bamboo curtain. And it's a very interesting episode, and I'm in the process of acquiring a lot of fascinating material. And one of the big challenge in doing these things is that the networks and the video and photo agencies charge a lot of money for the rights. CBS News charges more than $100 per second for use of video clips here. So there's a little flyer there. We're constantly looking for any kind of support, small, medium, or large. If you're an American, it's tax-free donation to the University of Southern California. If you know any wealthy business person who's very interested in the history of Hong Kong and might feel that preserving and helping people understand that part of Hong Kong's history is valuable, please spread the word, because that's the only way we can get this done. And I will, of course, make sure the Hong Kong premiere of that episode is here.
We're looking forward to that one as well. And it almost sounds like a segue for me to remind you now about Richard Hughes coming up Monday and the IRS is coming to get you, overseas Americans.
So donate
Tuesday.
A lot to the U.S.-China Institute
so
if you reduce your IRS bill.
Exactly. Do we have one more question here to wrap it up? Well, if not, why don't I just put in one more? What to you was sort of the biggest surprise as somebody who has spent now more years than almost anybody else in this room covering China? There must have still been something that when you went into looking at that period 40 years ago, you said, I mean, and you're familiar with the Shanghai Communique in particular, having lived in Taiwan where people still talk about it so much. What was the biggest surprise to you? What do you think people really don't appreciate it and you didn't even know before you started doing this?
I think one of the things that struck me was, with the benefit of hindsight, it all seems preordained. Nixon went to China, the Shanghai Communique, the door was open. But this was a very risky venture on multiple levels, diplomatically and even in terms of the press. And there are so many points during the course of this that it really could have gone off the rails when you think about it. I mean, first, politically, Nixon was antagonizing his own base. And in China, there, Lin Biao, Mao's designated heir, had died after some attempt against Mao just a few months earlier in September of 71, a story which your dad was instrumental in breaking, I should say. But there were severe internal tensions with China, inside China, over the wisdom of this opening to the States. So both leaders were taking big political risks. They did not have an agreement before Nixon arrived on a communique on all the language. I mean, normally today, no presidential trip would go anywhere if the lower rungs hadn't actually got everything worked out in advance. Mm-hmm. So there were big political risks. There are other kinds of risks which seem kind of silly in retrospect, but for a security-obsessed American president, he entrusted his physical security to the Chinese without any guarantee that they wouldn't haul off and shoot him or who knows what. I mean, he drove Chinese cars, he went on Chinese planes, he basically said to Zhou Enlai, I trust you with my life, which for a country that had been an American enemy, that was a risk. And in terms of the press, the fact that all this live stuff happened, I've been on enough live coverage episodes when I was at CNN where the feed crashed, it was green, there was no audio, I mean, all the things that can go wrong. It all worked. And even in the difficult encounters the press had, Dan Rather's minders made him go back to the hotel. Nobody hit him over the head with things that happened to reporters that could have really soured the atmosphere. So there's so many places in which this could have gone wrong that when you kind of relive it, you sense it, because no one knew from day to day that what the next day was going to bring. And that really kind of struck me, that there was a much more of a high wire act than it appears with the benefit of hindsight.
Great. Well, thank you all very much for coming. If you'd like to stay after,
Mike
would be happy to talk to you, and we hope to see you at more of our events coming up. Thank you all for coming.